Welcome to the Neurodiverse Love Podcast. I'm Mona Kay, and I was married for 30 years, in that relationship for 32, and we didn't find out we were a neurodiverse couple until our 29th year of marriage. And I've been divorced since 2018, and together we have an amazing adult daughter who's thriving and doing fantastic. And my hope is that the information shared in this podcast will help you understand the strengths, differences, and challenges in your neurodiverse relationship as you move forward in life. Welcome to the Neurodiverse Love Podcast. Welcome back to the Neurodiverse Love Podcast. I'm really excited for our conversation today with a neurodiverse couple. And their names are Tristan and Renee, and I'm talking to them, and they are in Sydney, Australia. So welcome, Tristan and Renee, to the podcast. I'm so glad that you all could be here to chat with me for a little bit.
Thanks, Mona. It's always lovely to speak with you.
Thanks for having us.
Oh, it's going to be great. So I would love if both of you or one of you would share a little bit about how you met, because you've been together, I think, for over 10 years. Is that correct?
Yeah, we've been married 11 years now. And I think we met, was it 14 years ago?
Yeah.
Coming wow. Up to- yeah. So tell us a little bit about kind of what the situation was and kind of what you were attracted to in each other.
Yeah, great. I love that question. I think we do need to share both because we do have slightly different stories, which is funny. You know, some stories are straightforward. Ours have, you know, differences from how we perceived how we met. So it's very funny to tell.
Okay.
Okay, should I start? All right.
Yeah.
So I was a student in Australia. It was my second gap year. But first I did work and travel, and then I started studying at a Bible college just out of Sydney and the beautiful Northern Beaches. And I thought, okay, this is the last year I'm going to, you know, dilly-dally around the world, and I have to start my serious life. So I was just, like, enjoying myself so much, studying what I loved, studied acting, and, yeah, had a great time meeting new people that year, but just always with the focus of going back to Germany at the end of that year. That's where I'm from. And so I came across Tristan probably from running through the office when I was interning with the kids department, and I saw him sitting at a desk sometimes, and he always said hi really cheerfully, but I just out of the corner of my eye saw this guy with a suit and a tie often sitting at the laptop punching in numbers. Somebody told me he's the finance guy of the and then when my friend asked me if I can do her costumes for her dance major work, it was her third year's performance. I came to the rehearsal, and then I saw Tristan. I knew Tristan's name, so I was like, oh, what's he got doing there? This is the finance guy. Why is he here? And then she told me, you need to see him dance. He got the main part. And I was just laughing. I couldn't imagine that. And then he was really amazing at his dancing, and I made his costume. So that's how our paths first crossed.
Oh, my gosh. I love that. So, Tristan, you didn't tell me you're a dancer. That's really cool.
Yeah, because it's not really a thing, but it was at the time. That's the point, Mona, yeah. And it was worth it.
Okay, worth so it what kind part. Of dancing? What kind of dancing, I have to ask?
I don't know how to describe it. It was like lyrical or interpretive dance. It was very free-flowing. It was like a third-year dance major work. So she was a student, but she really wanted to be, how do you call it, like nondescript. Ethereal. So I was this character on an adventure going through this fantasy land with all these things happening around me. And so Renee had to come up with quite like a creative fantasy-style costume for myself. And I'll share my side because I didn't pay any much attention to her when she'd sort of seen me in the office, but I did meet her for the first time at the first rehearsal, and the friend of mine who'd invited me to help was like, oh, this is the costume designer. And when I greeted her, I most remember her accent just stood out to me. She reminded me of someone I knew, and I just remember her smile, and she was one of these people that stood out just a bit more, but I didn't know why. It was just like, oh, that what a really like interesting, positive person. But then from then on, as soon as we spoke, each time we spoke, I felt like there was something, I guess, powerful or special about our connection. And we started speaking in between times we hang out on Facebook back in the day when Facebook was like a novel thing. And yeah. I remember she would share quotes with me and I was so like intrigued. What sort of person, let alone a girl, would share a quote with a guy? And I was like, there was a quote from Aristotle and then some from C.S. Lewis. And they're really interesting ones. And obviously I would share even better quotes back with her just to make sure I looked fantastic. And we had a really good discourse. And then like whenever I'd see her, I'd feel, you know, like excited and not sure what to say. And then when I'd be writing to her on Facebook, I found myself starting to probably just journal. I think I used Renee as like a space to share my, but to explore my own emotions and thoughts, something that I never did. I didn't have a space for that in my life at that point in time. But I found that space when writing to Renee. And pretty early on, I remember writing one response. We were talking about the nature of friendship and the nature of love. And when I'd written what I had to say, I felt a check in my spirit. Like, hang on, Tristan, are you sure you want to do this? And my finger was hovering over the mouse on the reply button. And it's hard to describe, but I felt as if the weight of the course of my life hinged upon the click without knowing why. And so I asked myself, do I want this? And there was just a resounding yes. And I didn't know what I was saying yes to consciously, but I clicked it. And then something really strange happened. From that moment on, I knew that I was going to marry Renee and the whole thing was sorted. And wow. It took a long time to work that out. But there was something that kind of clicked into place in that moment. And that was probably about 2 months in, maybe 2 or 3 months into having met her.
Yeah. And that's interesting because I didn't have it that like that. And I thought we were good friends. And then I had a few friends who pointed out, oh, he seems to really like you because he's always around you and he perks up every time you start talking and just see the way he glances at you a bit longer than he does at other people. And I was like, oh, no, I really didn't pick that up, you know. So I thought we were a bit platonic because I always had this mindset that, you know, I'm not going to stay in Australia, I'm not going to meet anyone here. So that's why it was just a really different frame of mind. But I do remember liking to talk to him. And I thought he's 2 years younger than me, but I found him quite mature for his age, or his thoughts were impressive. So, and we did have good discussions. So I really enjoyed those. But for the whole remainder of the year, I didn't really have that in focus that we're going to become a couple. My friends put that bee in my bonnet, but I was just like, nah, probably not, and stuff like that. And he was also not very direct with how he felt about me, because there was a rule at this college that in first year there's no dating. And he was respecting that, and I was more like, oh, he would probably tell me if there was something, if he had feelings, he'd probably tell me. But yeah, it was a bit of a surprise for me towards the end of the year when he did tell me, and I was like, oh really, I didn't see it like that. And then I was impressed that he wasn't shocked. He was like, oh okay, we'll work it out, you know, he was like that. And then yeah, and then I left, and then we stayed in touch, but not too
much.
As in
she went back overseas, right? Yeah. She went traveling.
Yeah, I left. I didn't say anything about coming back. I had no ticket or any plan to come back. We just departed, and then we stayed in touch, and Tristan just kept writing consistently, but also like long emails, and I was just not responding that long back, I think. But I did notice when he didn't write, you know. I was like, oh, did we stop our you know, long distance writing and stuff? Anyway, a year later or over.
I got to say, this is the funny part, because Renee has a clear memory of not having been warm to us being an item. But I could tell she was enjoying our time together, yeah, and the type of connection we had. And so as much as she thinks that it was impressive that I was pursuing her when she wasn't giving me anything, she was giving me so much. Just the way that she engaged with me, the way that she opened up, the way that she enabled me to open up in ways I'd never done before. It was literally the first relationship I'd had. I was 22 at that point, and I never had a girlfriend before. I never really pursued relationships. I'd been very focused on other things, to put it that way. And yeah, so it was, I was very naive, but also very innocent, I guess, like in a pure sense. So no fear, no inhibitions, no insecurities around not having anything reciprocated. It was clear to me that when I interacted with her, she was open, and that's all I needed. I didn't need her to say anything about it. It was just like, this makes sense. This feels right. Let's keep pursuing it.
Oh, my goodness.
I think that's quite beautiful, but at the time, yeah, it was interesting to me. You know, I was like, I've never told him that I've openly that I'm interested, but he's just so confident that this is going to go ahead. So that impressed me kind of, because I also saw in another guys around me, all my friendships, I just saw that some guys were on and off with their girlfriends, yeah, or even with engagements, on and off, or just being insecure and holding back. And I thought, well, this guy is super secure in this. So that was quite impressive to me. And it took me a while actually to warm up to the idea. And I had a lot of insecurities, I have to say. Like, I thought, what if he'll, like, he seems naive now. What if he'll change his mind? You know, I don't want to be dumped and stuff. I don't want him to, you know, rush into this because he's young and then later on leave me. And then I've changed country. So I felt I had more to lose, I guess. Sure. And that's why I was quite reserved for that whole time. But then I did want to come back to Australia, and I really just wanted to come to visit. And I booked a ticket and arrived. And then Tristan was more like, this is great. Our long distance relationship can now be official. And I was like, oh, it's so funny. Yeah.
So, okay. So I have to ask, because I know the listeners probably have a lot of questions, and I'm going to ask a few that I'm guessing some might have. How long, Tristan, was the time between, or Renee, that Tristan, you knew that you were going to marry Renee? She left and went back to Germany. How long did you all communicate on Facebook or however else you were communicated before you saw each other again? How long was that? Do you remember?
Yeah. So the time frames were, we operate like a calendar year. Our colleges run like February till December. So we met pretty much the middle of that calendar year. And Renee was in this zone where we couldn't be an item until December. So mm-hmm. I was certain that I was going to marry her in around July. But I found out that next week that she was in the program. I thought she was a second year student because she was a bit older than the others. I'm like, oh no, she's a first year. That means the rule applies. Okay, that changes the plan. So it was about 3 months or three or four months before I shared with her through a poem how I felt. And then she left about a month and a half later, after a lovely summer that we had together. And then she was away for about a year. So we were doing distance for a year. And then once she got back, it was probably by the following March. So pretty much short of 2 years since we met each other that we finally agreed, okay, let's make this work. And I proposed to her then. And after that, she went back overseas for another year, and we didn't get married until the next year when she came back. I think she came back later in that year. And then we sort of planned towards getting married in the following year after that. So it was a good 2.5 to 3 years of knowing each other, but only about, I think, 5 or 6 months was dedicated in our home country together. Well, in a country that we would call home, i.e. Australia.
But I felt that's true. And I felt there was a period for me between accepting that we're an official couple and we're telling our friends, and getting engaged was maybe 1 or 2 months. Mm-hmm. For me, that was really, really strange and quite a whirlwind.
Yeah, but not for Tristan, because he knew after a few months that he was going to marry you. And I have to ask, because I'm sure listeners are wondering, Tristan, you knew this in your head. You knew this in your heart. When did you tell Renee that you were in love with her? Or did you ever tell her that in person? Or was it, you know, the Facebook and the poems and, you know, whatever else you were sharing with her?
Thanks for sharing. I'm really embarrassed to say I can't remember the time he said that he loved me. I can't remember, although it would be such an important moment to remember. But I remember clearly one conversation where Tristan wasn't saying it much, but I needed to look at visas, and then I was like, what is this about? Is this going to end in marriage or what? And then all of a sudden Tristan was like, of course it is. Like, of course this whole thing has been about marriage. And I'm like, oh wow, you never said that. So funny. Yeah.
So that was the point at which Renee heard it from me, right?
And okay. That was 2 months before he proposed.
And we've had the privilege of each other for a few years beyond that. And this is a similar pattern, right? Where I'm so clear on something for a period of time. I was sure that I've communicated it in various ways. But then we find out like 3 years later that there's no clarity, and I've said nothing. In fact, I've often said the opposite in theory, and then I have to clarify. So I knew in my heart, I still wanted to sort of test it. So I went to a lot of mentors, and I spent about 3 months just checking myself, trying to logically process it through, because it was so solid on an emotional level. And I'm at this point, I'm completely blocked off from my emotions. I had no access to my emotions. They were literally like suppressed from me, unintentionally, unconsciously. I had an experience the following year where that uncorked, but I didn't know what was going on. But I still knew that something had happened under the surface level of my heart. So I had to process it logically. And then once I got clear on it, I wrote it in a poem, very cryptically, you would say. And then it wasn't until a month and a half later that Renee was like, I'm going overseas. I'm like, oh, but like, just so you know, like we'll keep this up. And she was still resistant to it at that point. And so in my mind, I'd already let her know through my actions and then through the poem. And then I pointed it out and then I continued persisting. And to me, in my like stubborn, narrow-minded way, like that's clear cut. Like, how could you not be certain that this guy is all on for you? And in my mind as well, once you're on for someone, there's no turning off. Like if you're planning to pursue, firstly, in my view, if you're pursuing someone, it's only for marriage. There's nothing other than pursuing someone for marriage. And then marriage is for life and there's no back door. So it was just this simple, like, linear thought to me. And that's probably why I didn't communicate it clearly at all.
It was very black and white to you. As far as you were concerned, you had the script in your head and there was no deviating from the script. And I just want to tell the listeners that we have two small kids in the background who are playing and exploring at Tristan and Renee's house. They have two small kids. So the noise you're hearing is two very creative kids enjoying themselves while their parents are on the Neurodiverse Love podcast. So I just wanted to let folks know you don't have a truck coming through your house or anything like that. So this is so interesting, okay? Because I know both of you are neurodivergent, and I don't know if you want to share a little bit about how you identify. That's really up to you. But understanding that you're a neurodiverse couple now, which you may not have known all these years, has definitely put you on a different path. And so let's talk a little bit about maybe how things have changed since you found out that you're both neurodivergent. And again, if you want to share your neurodiversity, you know, the type of neurotype you are, feel free.
Yeah. Do you want me to go first? Yeah. So I was the one that brought it up not too long ago. It was probably 8 or 9 months ago. I've been looking into it for about a year beforehand, mostly for others, had no intention of applying it to me or Renee. I'd already diagnosed Renee with how many things?
Yeah,
like three or four labels over the last decade. all of which I stand by, but they were all aspects of behavior that I was trying to make sense of. I'm a very outwardly oriented person. I'm always trying to solve other people's problems rather than my own. And I kind of outwork my own thoughts and feelings mostly in that context. My job is to be a consultant like that. And it only really struck, I'd say June last year, so it's now February the following year, where I'm like, oh, this is my family. Like my dad, my sister, probably my brother, certainly Renee, my first business partner, two of my three best friends, they're all the same profile. And then it took about 2 months after making that recognition that A, I have a lot of the same tendencies, nowhere near as pronounced. So these are ADHD tendencies, by the way. All those person mentioned, none of whom are diagnosed, but they're all very clearly ADHD. But then only sunk about 2 months ago that I'm the codependent in all those relationships that's like trying to fix, solve, and plug the gaps of their relation of their like cognitive dysfunction or like limited capacity in certain areas. And I would thrive on the ability to play that role, to support them. Mm-hmm. And that really played into this career role that I found myself in of doing the same thing for not just standard people. About 30% of my client book at that point were ADHD, were the diagnosed, which stood out to me beforehand as curious and surprising because I know that's not in line with the population average. But I thought maybe that's standard for our industry. And I realized it's not just our industry. It's also my personality type attracts this sort of person and sort of like enjoys playing this hand in a glove type codependent role, which I wasn't very good at having good boundaries for. And that was really insightful for me because I knew I had poor boundaries for the first part of our marriage. At least for 5 years, I had no idea on boundaries in our marriage. I just did everything I could, like a puppy dog, just wanting to help, just like, oh, I could do that for you. I can help you there. I can do that for you. Without realizing how, in many ways, disempowering, if not toxic, it was. And then when I started to put boundaries down, maybe about 6 years ago, I was just really blunt and clumsy and a bit brute about it. And obviously that didn't go down well. And I wasn't very good at adjusting. And through this last few months, I've been trying to work out what label to use for myself, mostly to communicate with others. But what I would say now is I'm at least mildly Asperger's, not diagnosable. I don't have any anxieties or the other disposition, like the emotional, I guess, challenges that typically come with it. Without going through the backstory, I ultimately suppressed my emotions entirely my whole teenage years, subconsciously, and then had a number of spiritual experiences in my early 20s that both uncorked that suppression, but also brought a lot of healing and resolve to it. And so the way I feel now is that I still have a default response to suppress emotion whenever I come into a conflictual situation, and therefore I'm very hypervigilant in those times. But I'm much more in touch with my emotions either at the time or shortly afterwards. And I'm very grateful for that, but I'm still coming to terms with what that mechanism is when I use it too much, when I could be more vulnerable and open, and even where I can be more fickle, because there's a beauty to being fickle, I'm realizing, in relationships. And as a result, how can I love better? So I don't have, I think, an effective label. I would love to find a better vocabulary for who I think is the majority of people who actually sit somewhere on the neurodiverse spectrum, but they're not officially diagnosable, but they definitely have the personality traits and some of the dispositions, whether autistic or ADHD.
Yeah, I think that's so interesting, because I think the Diagnostic Statistical Manual and a lot of therapists, psychologists, folks that do assessments and evaluations, if they're using the DSM or whatever's used overseas, I know there's different tools, and they're using the assessment tools that have been used with young boys primarily. Yeah. There are so many people that are not going to be diagnosed using that criteria, but they've always felt different. I know that I've always felt different. I'm very emotional. I have not really ever kept a job for more than 2 or 3 years. I'm always looking for the next dopamine hit. And right. Now I know I am ADHD. I am very, very ADHD, but do I fit the DSM criteria? I do not fit them all. So I hear what you're saying. And I think the most important thing, Tristan and Renee, is for us to understand our own brains, our own needs, our own sensory issues, and to be able to communicate that to the people that we care about in our life who want to get to know us better. And then I think that makes for healthier relationships with ourselves and with the people that we care about. That's Mona's soapbox.
I'll join you. I'm there with you.
Okay.
Yeah, Mona, so, I love what you just said. If I can just illustrate that.
Yeah.
Such a good thing, because I'm also ADHD. And what's it called when you can't stand the noises?
Highly sensitive.
Yeah, highly sensitive as well. But I always thought that was just, I didn't know what it was. I just always knew I was different. And then I just thought I was creative. But then I had a lot of experience of failure in school growing up, just because I think my teachers didn't know how to deal with me. And I concluded that I wasn't smart. And couldn't do things. So I had a small mindset about myself, and I just floated through life doing the things I loved because they made me feel good. But I really, it was really hard for me to tackle things, hard things, but just because I had so many experiences of not finishing well. And then when Tristan helped me in the beginning, just doing things for me, I guess I became really lazy and dependent on him in a way that wasn't good for our relationship, because when he pulled back, I got really fearful and angry. And often anger is a sign of fear. So I think the underlying root was fear. Like, if he pulls away from me, what do I have left? So I didn't have a strong sense of self at that time. And I think that's been my journey the last bit of it, like the last few years, and especially in the last year, and especially in the last 8 months since knowing this more, because I actually didn't really understand what was wrong with myself. I just knew things were wrong. But I didn't want to turn to medicine. I didn't want to turn to too many alternative feelings. I was just like, what is it? And we have a faith. So I found some relief in our faith, but I knew there was more, you know, I knew there was a life for me with peace and freedom and in a healthy relationship. So, but I didn't know how to pursue that. And I think I was stuck in that moment of like, I know something's wrong. I want to fix it. I have a person next to me who wants to fix it, but I felt we just didn't have clues and didn't have tools to move ahead. And a few of our support people around us who we went for mentoring and counseling, I feel didn't know either how to support us really well. So that was a big shock to me and surprise. I was like, oh man, how many couples are like this are out there? So I thought if we pull through strong, hopefully we can learn things and then help a few people. But first, most, it's for us, for our children, like for our family needs to heal. And we're still on a healing journey, which is the exciting thing. You know, we're still not out the end. I don't know when we'll be, but it sometimes feels like every day is a repetition of the day before. But I'm just hoping with some of these clarities, we can move ahead. But I loved how you said we need to communicate to the other person what we need. And I think that's brought us a bit of relief, being able to say, I need this because this is how my brain works. This is how my feelings work. And I'm not dad, and I'm not silly, and I'm not worth, you know, I don't have to be exiled because of these things. I deserve to be worked with. And then the next step is how do we work with each other? But we had to come to this moment of we're sticking together, although it's probably going to be really hard. But, you know, we've chosen each other. And I guess that's the glue that's holding us together, our commitment.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. That's so beautiful. I mean, everything that you both have said, I think is going to resonate with so many folks that are listening. And I love what you said about that you deserve peace and freedom and a lasting, healthy relationship. Yeah. And I think that comes, Renee, from us knowing ourselves. And, you know, my heart goes out to you when you said you didn't feel like you fit in or you didn't feel like you were worthy. And I think so many folks who are neurodivergent and don't know feel that way. And then when they get either a diagnosis, an official diagnosis, or they start self-identifying as neurodivergent, there becomes the beginning, it doesn't happen overnight, the beginning of some clarity about why they felt the way they did growing up. I remember my ex-husband was bullied. I mean, he was really bullied. His parents sent him away to live with his grandparents for a year because they were afraid for his life. You know, he was not treated well. And now I understand why some of those things happened. I don't know if he fully understands, but he was different. He was, you know, probably, we call it Mensa here. I don't know if you have Mensa in Australia, but, you know, genius, right? Mm-hmm. And he was able to do things that other people were not able to do. And he was able to do them easily. I won't go into the details, but things that would have taken others years to do. And, you know, you were a costume designer. That is not something that everybody is talented in and able to do, Renee. But because it came to you naturally, probably, you didn't see it as a strength. Would you say that or am I?
Yeah, it's so interesting what you just said. I felt all my life I was told by people to pick one thing and do it really well. And I couldn't do that. I had to start everything and I did everything sort of. But I loved it and I had some good results. But I would never have considered myself any one thing. I was just dabbling in all these creative forms. You know, I love poetry, but a lot of people said I should write a book, release my poems. But then I'm just held back by my dyslexia. So I would need a lot of editing. But that's just one hurdle. But in my mindset as well, you know. So all my life, I was told, you know, what to do and how to do it. And I've just always thought I need to do things my way. But then in the end, I don't do any of it. So I know I have a lot in me and a lot to give. Uh-huh. But I would have to find a bit of coaching for my creativity because I'm just like stumbling into everything and then just hiding.
I hear you. Yeah. I hear you. I totally hear you. So I know that both of you are on probably your own individual healing journeys. You're discovering who you are as individuals. You're maybe rediscovering who you are as a couple and a family. And I know, I'm guessing, I don't want to speak for you. I'm guessing that when you fell in love, the person you fell in love with might be very different than the person that your partner is now. because you're going through that journey of learning about yourself and growing and probably trying to step into more of your authentic self. I loved that you said you're committed to each other, even though you're having such a difficult time. Can you tell me a little bit about kind of what made you make that commitment to each other as you go through this growth together? Because my ex-husband said, I'm done, but we were together for 32 years. He said, I'm done. I don't have any more bandwidth left for you. I don't want to do any more work. I'm done. And I understood, you know, of course it was emotional, but I understood. Can you tell us what made you think of things in a way that might be different from some other neurodiverse couples who are struggling and deciding, I'm done?
Can I start there?
Yeah.
Yeah, this is a real, I guess, passionate topic for me, Mona. My upbringing, the faith I learned, so Christian faith, has a really simple tenet that God is our source, our creator, and he formed us, designed us, and loves us in a way that our language doesn't really describe or define well. There's lots of different versions of love and definitions of love. The Greek agape is one of the better versions. It's not perfect, but it's like this perfect, unconditional, unending, undying, wise and patient form of love that will wait for decades or centuries or generations for not just a person, but for a group of people to turn. It's the love that a parent naturally has for their child, even when they're stubborn and tantruming and they are being triggered emotionally, but below the emotion, they know that they have only good to give to their child and they only want the best for that child. It's the love that's willing to discipline, even though it can be so frustrating and challenging to discipline your child when you want the best for them. It just like withholding an ice cream from a child is so hard sometimes as a parent when you love them and you want the best for them, but you just know it's not good. And that's just a taste, I think, of this agape. Mm-hmm. So I was taught that, but more importantly, I was shown it. I was given it in spades, particularly by my mom, who's an incredible caregiver. She committed her entire life, really, to me and my two siblings, but I think even more to me in some regards than the other two, just because of the way things panned out. And my beautiful, loving, supportive church and school community that were the same. Was full of every single teacher was the exact same experience. I'd say every parent I hung out at the family house of had the same vibe. It was just a very consistent experience of this agape. And so when I learned it, you know, on the Sunday school or when I read it in the book, it was just pointing out what I already felt in my bones. And you can call that secure attachment. You can call it lots of different things, but to me, it's the most fundamental revelation that any human needs, and it's the single most important thing to give to a child when you're a parent. I think it's our primary job is to give that experience to our children, whether we got it or not. And obviously, it's extremely difficult to pass that on if you didn't first receive it. It's probably impossible in some ways. So why I think that's so fundamental is that that agape is most manifest in the contract of marriage, which I see as a spiritual contract first. It has obviously a governmental element to it, and there's a document you sign and, you know, the state gets involved and whatever, but the notion that you would commit to someone and endeavor to manifest that agape in this one relationship more than anything else, no matter how they show up, no matter how they hurt you, no matter what they do, there's really no escape hatch, you know. Like I'm not gonna like make any bold statements around situations of abuse and these other situations, but my personal belief is that no matter what Renee might do to me, that my job is to love her through it and to grow to be the bigger person and to enable that agape love, which is not just an experience, it's a transforming force. It's the most powerful force in this universe, and it will shift, heal, and adjust the heart of anyone that I can consistently channel it to, if I'm willing to commit myself to it. And the beautiful but scary part about it is it costs so much to do. And we are so limited that we can only do it to one or two or three people, probably just one, in fact, maybe not even one in an entire lifetime. And so it's the grandest endeavor, I think. Having children is an extension of marriage in that form. And obviously having children is incredible and raising those kids. We're in the thick of it with 5 and 1 year old. But eventually they'll get to 20 and 30. And my role will refocus entirely on Renee and where she's at and how I can continue to love her. You made a comment just a few minutes ago about this idea that we change. And I think that's a really important thing to recognize. But my fundamental belief is that we don't change, that we just see things differently. And most of the time we think we know who we're marrying, but we've got no idea. We don't even know the top of the iceberg. Like, you know, icebergs are 10% above the water and 90% below.
Yeah.
We don't even know the top 10% when we get married. And Renee and I did 2.5 years, actually probably 3.5 years by the time we actually got married. Some couples go for 6, 7, 8 years these days. They've been living together the whole time. We didn't live together. But even then, you still have no idea what's going to come out because you haven't lived with them through their entire life. They haven't had kids and seen this beautiful reflection of their greatest insecurities coming back at them. You haven't seen them at their worst. There's no way you can know what is within someone as a 20, 30-year-old. And so I believe the only thing that can make a relationship work for the long term is that agape. And not only is it the only thing, it's the most beautiful and powerful thing. And so that was, I guess, my theology. You could say it's philosophy. It's how I see the world. But more importantly, it was my experience growing up. And so not that I've been perfect in living it out. It's hard work. But I have nothing but desire and commitment to grow into the man to be able to live that love out. And our marriage is the primary context that I'm called to do that in. Because it's societally the main context, but also in my life, it's the most challenging and most real context to living out in.
Wow. That's a lot to take in and a lot for me to sit with. And I think it resonates for me, Tristan, as what I think it's Harville Hendricks talks about. He and his wife, Helen Hunt LaKelly, talk about conscious relationships and about how in our marriages or our long-term romantic relationships, we have the opportunity to grow and learn and heal in ways that we don't have in any other relationship we will have in our lives.
Right.
And I don't know that we all take that to heart or as seriously as it sounds you are on a mission to do. And I think if we did, maybe we'd have different outcomes during our relationship and maybe fewer divorces or fewer relationships ending. And again, I'm not talking about abuse either. I'm talking about, you know, not understanding each other and not recognizing that differences are healthy and that we don't need to try to change our partners. We need to really try to understand each other. But first we have to understand ourselves. And that is not something we're taught in school, right? So it sounds like you both have made this commitment to really understand each other and to grow together. And I'm sure, you know, with two young children, you're going through, you know, a different season of your relationship. And I know as you're learning about your own neurodivergence, the changes can be very quick or sudden. And you may find something that you were masking on or start unmasking because it feels more comfortable or something that you feel is a need, whether it's emotional or sensory or whatever, and you're communicating that to each other. How are you dealing with those changes as you begin to unmask and become more of your authentic selves? How is that unfolding for both of you?
Thanks for asking for the question. I love this question. When Tristan earlier shared about agape, I completely agree with that. And that's been really good for us or for me, seeing that Tristan has that as a foundation and a goal. But although like working it out, like in our limited forms, that's been the challenge, I think. Like, I'm so glad that Tristan has that as an umbrella philosophy over our marriage. But oh my gosh, did we struggle how to do that, you know? And my parents didn't example a good marriage to me, and they stayed together, but they didn't improve. So it's been hard, you know, to have seen that, you know. seen a marriage that wasn't healthy but didn't move forward and didn't break up. So I didn't see how, you know, people setting each other free would look like. And I remember having said this a few times, saying to Tristan, I'm done, I'm out, I can't do this. Putting my finger over the D button, you know. But Tristan just was like, there's no way we'll do that. But then I said, okay, then things need to change because I can't carry on 30, 40 years like this. Like, if I'm staying, it needs to have a drastic impact. And we've gone through that, around that mountain a few times, you know. So it's been a long journey. And one thing that I need, but why I didn't give up and why I didn't leave yet is I do hunger and long so much for redemption. And I'm with all the pain needs to pay off somehow. And I'm like, when I say to God, I'm like, there's got to be a reason for this. And it has to be an amazing life on that, you know, coming out of this. You know, we will have such a great, you know, whatever it is. I would love to, you know, be like spreading the word like you do in forms of podcasts or books, or just being a speaker of some sort, or writing a book, or writing courses, you know, and just spreading what we've learned. Like, it's, I've got a passion just like Harville and Helen, you know, like once you understand something, you can't hold it for yourself because you need to help another couple. So for me, I'm like, this needs to pay up all of our hardship, you know, and this is what actually kept me going to want to know our kids will see us rise from this, you know, our future generations. Because I thought it would have been easy to go separate ways. But probably in how you said earlier, we will probably grow the most within this relationship. And one thing that I didn't do well when we met, and I think we say it easily, I know some people put it in their wedding vows, I think I came across this sentence later, but to love the future version of someone. Back in the day, I was not doing that well. I had to love the version that I thought he is, you know. And when he diverted a little bit off that, I was like, it can't be. You have to be the illusion that I created. whereas with this, I will love the future version of you. Oh, my goodness. How many options are that? You know, endless. He could become a transgender, or he could run for president. Like, he could do all the crazy things that I will have to then, you know, be willing to love him through, which will be so challenging. But we have to say yes to that. I have to love the person he's not yet. And that's, for me, like, mind-blowing. But I also know that that's going to be one of the secrets that will keep me through, keep me going.
That is really profound and scary and beautiful at the same time, Renee. Because I think a lot of us fall in love with the potential that our partners have for the future, and they don't always realize that potential because we may be living in a fantasy world, kind of what you said, you know, that illusion, that Disney version of what a relationship or a marriage should be. And I know that I almost gave up on my marriage 4 years in because my ex-husband wasn't moving towards reaching his potential. And we ended up staying together for another 26 years. So, you know, I realized that I still loved him and we worked on it. But not everybody is that fortunate, that strong-willed, that willing. And so I think what you both have said is going to be really helpful to a lot of folks. What do you think in the last, let's say, 8 to 12 months have been, for both of you, the one or two things that you've learned about yourself that has been helpful, and then the one or two things you've learned about each other or your relationship that has been helpful, if you don't mind sharing?
Yeah, practical questions. I love these. I'll extend it just over the last few years. You mentioned Helen and Harville, learning the Imago process that they teach. That's like their central tool. It's like a dialogue process. It's very simple. Yep. It's like how to listen to someone, has been transformational for me. I didn't know what to do in Renee's emotional moments. I'd tried so many things and I never persisted with any one strategy long enough to break through, and nothing seemed to work. It seemed to be getting worse and worse, harder and harder, and the episodes got more dramatic and more devastating. And I felt really, started to feel insecure, because normally I back myself as the guy that has the solution for every problem. I'm the key to every problem. But in that scenario, I felt like I had to just cower and slink back because I had nothing to bring. I tried to fail, and that was really painful. But the Imago process it's like an incredible plan B. No matter, there are better solutions than just listening. But sometimes I'll go into imago mode for 45 minutes straight, and Renee will just pour out and pour out. And the first 20 minutes is tearing me to shreds. And if I can just listen, just actively listen, not like go silent and pretend to be a statue, but like properly hear her, then we get through that chapter, and we get to then the rest of the world being blamed for all of her ills for another 10 or 15 minutes. And then you get to what I call the gold, where she's actually reflecting and she starts beating herself up horribly and pointing out all her faults and goes into a little bit of a depressed shell herself. And then if I've done that well enough, and I struggle with that last stage, I connect with it. It brings out my warmth, but I don't go down to those depressive parts very well. And I struggle to listen and probably hear them. But when I can, we have just a nice moment of not much said. There's no appetite for Tristan to share, but there's a space for us to just be together. And that's a much more authentic being.
Mm-hmm.
And like that in itself, I mean, it doesn't always last that long, but that pattern is a healthy pattern. And at any point, I know I can engage that and we'll get there. And that's become a baseline. Now I know I can find other things. I can be more assertive. I can lead more effectively. The biggest thing I've changed in the last 8 months is choosing to be more persistent in being assertive in our relationship. Not just with boundaries. I was persistent with boundaries, but I wasn't being assertive. I was being a wall rather than being a leader, a guide, a director. And I think that's a difficult thing these days because, like, on average, blokes have less testosterone and women have more. And our society is structured in such a way that men lose a lot of their ability and context for being a leader. And the few times that they have that, it's seen as quite negative and it's not exampled very well, right? And very few of us have good fathers who show it strong and pure and loving in the first place. So it's very hard to be a leader, I think, as a man these days, more than in the past. And it's all the more vital because I think that's the only thing that will help marriages stick together is when leadership. And I'm not good at it. I didn't get good exampling from my dad. I didn't know the role. So I'm now challenging myself regularly to shift into that. And can you guess what I've received from Renee in response?
To being more assertive?
Yeah.
Well, it's either going to be one of two things. Either she hates it or she feels more safe and loves it.
And I think it's both, but more the first. Like I see a lot of the first, like resistance, pushback, anger, frustration. How dare you? You've never done this before. Where's this coming from? I'm going to challenge you and I'm going to chip away at this assertiveness until it goes back into its shell. Like that's what you get, especially when you've been passive for a long time. That's what you get. And obviously my past self would have been like, that strategy is not working. Not trying that one again. And I'm sure I've done versions of that in the past, but I've stuck with it long enough, like only 8 months, I reckon now, to see the early fruit, not just short term, but like, you know, medium term fruit in Renee's life. So that's probably the single biggest thing I've shifted in myself.
Okay.
But at the same time, we've also found a coach who is working with both Renee individually and us collectively. Doing mediation with us and then also working with Renee, and he's a valued friend and a partner of ours, and he's a safe space for Renee and he's a safe space for both of us. And he's probably more skilled and also more persistent and willing to roll up his sleeves than anyone else we've found. We've had beautiful coaches and mentors and psychologists in the past, but we've pretty much been sacked or had to end these relationships after a period of time for various reasons, mostly because I think they lost heart. They lost the vision that they could help us.
Right. And I think that happens with a lot of therapists and coaches who don't understand neurodiverse couples.
Right.
And how mixed neurotype couples can connect in very different ways. And it's not healthy maybe to them, but it could be healthy to the couple. So I just, before Renee, before you answer, and I want you to answer this because I think it's going to be critically important. I just want to say that I love the way you described how you use the imago process with Renee, because Renee, I can relate to what Tristan was saying about how your emotions go, and he's trying to stay with it and he's trying to process it and he's trying to be there for you. And I think if you would be a fly on the wall of my marriage, you would have seen me do the same things, but my ex not knowing what to do with all my emotions, us not having the right strategy, tools, techniques. We didn't know about Imago then. I know about it now. Mm-hmm. So thank you for sharing how that has helped you. And it, like you said, being very vulnerable and honest, it is not easy stuff because all, excuse me, all the shit comes up.
Yeah.
And you want to run oftentimes, but you're committed. I think that's awesome. I keep saying
as if it's like when I hear someone emotionally sharing things, I always take it at face value and think they mean what they say. And it's been a very slow process to realize people don't mean what they say in those times. They just say whatever. It's like they're being attacked by something and they're picking up rocks or anything around them and they'll throw whatever is near them at that threat to try and protect themselves. And they're not mindful of what they're doing. They have no idea what they hurled. They probably aren't even going to remember it. You know, it's like it's a trauma experience and that doesn't devalue them as a human. But I've had to create a whole new frame for what's said and what's done in those times. There is a reason why each individual word is used, but the reason is not the surface value reason that you might judge it to be. And so I have to switch off my analytical brain entirely and go into what I would call a meditative state. I think Imago, when done well, is a external meditation. You're meditating not on yourself, but you're meditating on them and their world and trying to grasp their world.
I love that. I love that. And I think it's really important for the audience to hear what you just said. So I'm going to repeat it, that the words that come out of your partner's mouth may not be words that you can believe in the moment when they're emotionally dysregulated. Because I think when we say things when we're emotionally dysregulated or do things when we're emotionally dysregulated, oftentimes, and I would guess maybe 100% of the time, but I don't think anything's 100% of the time. We're coming from a place of fear and we're just trying to keep ourselves safe, or we have a need that we desperately need met and we're not able to meet it for ourselves. So we're looking for our partner to meet it and they're not meeting it.
Yeah.
So we're lashing out. And when we understand that, we can be a little bit more compassionate and patient with ourselves and our partner. So thank you for that. And then the assertiveness piece, and then I want Renee to share what she's learned. The assertiveness piece I think is really important for all mixed neurotype relationships. I think oftentimes we don't know how to be assertive, and assertiveness is not aggressiveness. Assertiveness is more around boundaries, and our boundaries are created and communicated to protect us. They're not to put up walls so that our partners can't get through. And I think in the most healthy relationships, there are clear, concise boundaries that both partners understand and are willing to abide by. That's just my thought. That's Mona's soapbox regarding that.
Love
it.
So Renee, thank you so much, Tristan. I think that what you said is so powerful and it's going to be really helpful. Renee, what about you? What do you think you've learned about yourself and, you know, Tristan or your relationship that maybe has been challenging and also helpful?
Yeah, great. I'm just thinking, you know, how in other cultures, I'm so passionate about other cultures because, you know, where Western thinking hasn't come in yet, they have this, they accept people being in crisis. And it's a normal thing, and it's also a good thing, and sometimes praise. And I can tell in the Arab world and Jewish world, you know, they have these words for it. It's a cool thing, and I've learned this from Khalil Gibran's poetry and from his books that it's a good thing, you know, to go into the desert and freak out, and you know, and then come back and maybe rediscover yourself again. You know, those things are actually applauded in other cultures, and I here have had a bit of shame around that, like thinking, you know, I need to present such a fantastic, you know, facade of like holding it all together and being the perfect wife and perfect mother and, you know, homeschool mom and like juggling all these things and then earning some money and then volunteering, you know, just too much. And I kind of drop the balls and then have a huge tantrum and throw everything away. And I then feel some of my friends couldn't always deal with it, or like people who are not that close to me couldn't deal with it. And the people who are close to me are now realizing, oh, she does bounce back, and she bounces back in such a better way. She's healthier, stronger, and knows something new. And I think Tristan needed to come to that as well. Like, oh yeah, she will crash and burn, but it's not, you know, final. Like she has this ability to get back on her feet, brush herself off, and be like, okay, let's open the window and have some fresh air. Yeah. So I think yeah, having a crisis for me is important, but I want to learn to do that well and to not hurt others in the process. Like, as Tristan admitted, this is one thing I'm embarrassed about. I shredded Tristan to pieces with my words, but it was also hurting myself. So it was actually directed to myself, you know, the self-hatred, which I want to tackle and not abuse in future. You know, I want to actually just like get down to what I'm really trying to say, rather than hurling something around that I don't understand, just as Tristan explained it. So having more understanding has been so good with that. But what I need from Tristan is, and he's been becoming better, but it is the empathy part, because it's not just listening. You know, I personally find AI a little bit creepy, because it's this force of intelligence, but it doesn't have the human aspect to it, you know, the one that really mm-hmm. feels for someone. And that's what I find sometimes Tristan maybe did. He sat and went, uh-huh, and nodded his head. And I felt, I could just tell he doesn't know what I mean, you know, and that was the frustrating part. But now, and this is what I feel the masculine needs to learn from their feminine, and there's a really beautiful dance when it's done well. There's the spiritual, the intuition, the feminine, and Tristan mentioned meditation, and this is wonderful. You know, meditation is a spiritual thing. Prayer is a spiritual thing, and it's actually easier for women. Men have to get out of their minds, out of the analytical heads, and into their body, feeling more. And I think that's what would be so helpful for me more while we're having conversations. And he can use Imago techniques, which has helped us, and other techniques like spiral dynamics has helped us. You know, there's so many modules. NLP mm-hmm. has all helped us, but it has to be with love. I don't think we can teach anyone without love. And the moment I feel that Tristan sees value in me, I'm less the wildcat, you know, thrashing around with claws. It's more, okay, maybe the to help me. I don't need to fight him. You know, that I just need value placed on me, and then I respond completely different to the pressure I'm feeling. I can actually sit and learn as soon as I know I'm valued and loved. And Tristan over the years thought he communicated that, but it didn't reach me. Only now, also our coach who Tristan mentioned, he always finishes our phone call, I say bye, and then he always says, you're worth it. Like, it's just a beautiful sentence to hear for anyone. Like, anyone needs to hear it, from when we're small till we're really old, you know, just that places value on us while we're going through a crisis. It just helps us go through that on the other side and be like, whew, that was hard, but I did this, and now I'm back ready to give, because someone needs something from me in the world. So as soon as Tristan says, you know, let's work on our marriage because, you know, our kids need this, or our community needs us to be back on our feet, I'm like, yeah, you're right, that we do have value. That's been all the change for me.
That's so beautiful. Yeah, and I remember Oprah Winfrey used to say, and she probably still says it, you know, the most important thing that we all need is to be heard, seen, and valued and understood. And when we get that from the people that we love and care about in our lives, it really makes a difference. And when we don't get it, sometimes we question our own worth and our own value. Yeah, I so understand that. So understand that. And there's, you know, I think we're all going to be a work in progress as long as we're on this earth. Mm-hmm. And yeah. Some people choose not to be a work in progress, and they don't want to do any, you know, internal work, and they don't want to work with their partners. And that's okay, you know, if you're being honest and you don't want to do that. But it sounds like you both are on a journey together. It's not easy. I know it's not. At all, but it sounds like you're both committed to learning about yourselves and to loving each other and learning together. And I think that's awesome. So we're at the end of the podcast, and I want to know if there's anything else that either one of you want to share with the listeners that you thought of while one or the other was talking.
I'm so glad. Yeah, definitely. And it's to do with this thought, which is an insidious thought in my mind, that someone's not willing, not able, not going to grow a change. I don't think it too often, but it creeps in my mind from time to time. And I actually hate that thought. I've made it a virus. I've personified it. Now I seek it out. And when I find it, I try to eject it as quickly as possible. And I see it's a perspective that a lot of people take, especially within their marriage or with their kids or with their loved ones. Mm-hmm. And I see it's the thought, the idea that someone is like that, it's just similar to the idea of calling someone who's ADHD lazy. Mm. It's a way to justify something that we're not comfortable with, but we don't feel capable ourselves to change. Whereas when you come to a different perspective that, for example, they are desiring to grow and change like every human is, you can't take that away from human. Every human has that desire, just like gravity will always force upon an object. Every human, no matter how old or young, has a desire to grow, change, and heal. It's natural, it's innate, it's gifted. I've not met a single human who has proved me wrong. But there are other forces that play against that gravity, like lift. Like when you have a plane traveling really fast along the ground, it will lift up against the air and gravity no longer pulls it down because the lift is stronger than the gravity. And right. I've reversed the analogy here, but you have this desire for growth, but there's fear which pulls us down. And so I like a different equation that, because Renee, in her words and her actions, regularly, I would say more often than not, is in the mode of, I don't want to work on myself. I don't want to change. I don't want to do these things. And it's very easy, and I've done this for many years in the past, to take her at face value. That's what she's saying. That's what she's acting very consistently. Maybe she's not. And I can imagine if that was the only worldview I had, that I would be forced to exit our relationship at some point. Because if you accept that they're not going to grow, why? Like it's like a form of self-flagellation to stick around. That's why I see it as a virus. It's toxic. It shouldn't be there. I think the truth is that people just don't know how. That lazy kid just doesn't know how to focus. They haven't learned the techniques that they have access to, but they don't know where or how or when, or they haven't practiced it, not strong at it. They get distracted from it. The simplest thought is that there is a way. How can I help them find the way? And to me, that creates opportunities. It creates desire and it creates like excitement. Like, oh, this is a project. This is a mission. And my mind gets engaged by missions. I don't know. Maybe that's not attractive to other people. But as soon as I can recognize, here's a project we can solve together. And I can't fix it for her because she has to be the one that does it. But my question is, how can I guide, assist, equip, support her to be able to do it? She just doesn't know the way just yet.
Okay. And I thank you so much for saying that. And I will say that for someone who was in a 30-year marriage, and I'm saying this because I know there's going to be listeners that are listening to you, Tristan, and they're like, gosh, I wish my husband or my partner or my wife was like that. They would never say something like that. Well, also, I do believe that, so we're going to agree to disagree. I do believe that at some point, because I'm 60, right? I do believe at some point you're just exhausted. And that wasn't my case. I wasn't exhausted. I did not want a divorce, but my ex-husband said to me, I don't have any bandwidth left. I don't want to do the work. I don't want to do anything else. I can't give anymore. He said, when we first were together, I had a bucket full of bandwidth for your emotions. Now I don't even have, or I barely have a thimble. Okay. I had to accept his words because the actions were congruent with the words. That's where I have a different opinion of this, because if the person's actions are not congruent with the words and they're trying to learn and they're trying to grow and they're trying to do things differently, but they're saying that they're not willing, then I think there's room for learning and growth. Because you're right, we're not taught these tools, strategies, how to be in a relationship with another human being that we love and is totally different from us. We're not taught any of that ever, you know, unless we go for coaching and mentoring and premarital counseling and all of that. So I would love to have this conversation with you all in 10 years, because if you keep on this growth kind of journey and discovering more about yourselves and each other, I think you're going to be in a fabulous place. I think you're going through a really tough, you know, time now as you're discovering more about yourselves and each other, but you can come out of this and be the power couple of the universe. But not everybody, because if you had not known about your neurodiversity for another 10 years, we might be having a different conversation. So I don't know if either one of you have any thoughts about that. And if Renee, you have any closing thoughts, we can go longer because this is important to talk about. Do you have any?
Well, I definitely love this conversation. Maybe we can do a part two. but closing thought for today, I have just this one thing that I believe that, you know, when we don't have love to give inside of us because we're so limited, I do think we can access the agape love from God. I really do know that it's just a prayer away, and we can say, just help me love because I can't do it at the moment. And I do believe that some supernatural empowerment does come. So I've seen it in my own life, but I'm also still learning of how to use it. But it's not a magic wand that makes problems go away. But there is some sort of beautiful magic out there that does actually just lift you a little bit when we spoke about lift. Like it does just give the heart that little spark of courage, and then we can do with it what it is. But it's nice to know that in this vast universe and me feeling like, you know, a speck of dust, we are not alone and we're seen. And, you know, that there is love that is like it's a energy force, like a love force that we can tap into. It is available to everyone.
I agree with that. Renee. Yeah, I agree with that. I agree. And I think for those couples that have been together for 20, 30, 40 years, some of them are just exhausted and they don't think that they can tap into that. And with the right coach or the right therapist, maybe they can. So I agree with you. So Tristan, did you want to have the last word? Thank you so much, Renee, for sharing, for your vulnerability, for putting so many important things out there to the listeners and to the world. Did you have anything else, Tristan? Because I kind of pushed back on what you said, and I want to give you the last word.
No, I think we both shared our views really concisely, and I think they stand well beside each other. Just kind of like, I think the best ideas juke each other out to bring forth the truth. The ideas are not the truth. The ideas are like digging machines that work their way towards the truth. And yeah, I think that's an unresolved conversation. And it's only thing I wanted to add was that I'm really grateful for the chance to share. Like I was a month and a half ago, not even sure if Renee wanted to do this chat because her calling herself ADHD is kind of like a very recent thing. It's a very public way to discuss it. But you obviously facilitate a really beautiful space from our previous conversations and today. And more importantly, I think that what you've decided to do in this chapter of your life is such a gift. And we just want to do whatever we can to support, endorse, and esteem what you're doing and to distribute it for you. Because I think more people need the voice and the support that you have to offer. You got so much wisdom and you got a big heart to offer. Mona, so thank you.
And I feel that you both have such wisdom and big hearts because, you know, you're going through a lot and you have two young children, so, and you keep learning and growing. If folks want to get in touch with either one of you, is there a place, are you on social media, is there an email that they can reach out to you at? Because there may be folks that want to reach out to you, and if there isn't, that's fine, but I thought I'd ask just in case.
Yeah, of course. I mean, like I mentioned, I'm a consultant. So professionally, we help people with ADHD in particular work on their money and work on their business. We're financial advice, business coaching, and life coaching. But on a separate note, if someone wants to connect with me personally, go through the same channel, connect with me via my business, and just say, hey, I'd love to hear more about your personal story. I'd love to chat. I'm open to engage on a professional or a personal basis for anyone that's interested.
And you want to give the website address or your email address?
Yeah, the company is called purposeadvisory.com.au. And my email is just tristan@purposeadvisory.com.au. You can find my details on LinkedIn or on the website.
Wonderful. All right. And I will put all that in the show notes. Thank you both. And please give your kids a big hug because it sounds like they were enjoying themselves and they let you do this for over an hour. So I really appreciate it. Thank you both immensely. I really, really appreciate it.